Welcome back, one and all, to Out of the Main, Born at Sea, Raised on Radio, and now, what, sneaking into a jazz club, John Nixon?
We could have said Raised on a Victrola, maybe. We're going way back, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, we sure are. Welcome back, everyone, and we are about to welcome back a repeat visitor to the podcast. As you may recall, we have told you, any supporters to the podcast, which you could do by hitting the support the podcast link in the show notes below, enables you to come on the podcast at least once an episode and join us, which our guest is going to today, or just simply dictate or direct what the content of an episode would be. So you may remember him from an exploration of the Steely Dan album Asia, correct?
Nope.
And
The Nightfly.
Wasn't it Nightfly?
Oh, it was Gaucho.
It was Nightfly.
Okay,
I'm
going to
keep
closer.
All that in.
Good. Well, we better get it on before I state too many things erroneously. Okay. And he is none other than listener Jonathan. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thank you guys for having me. It's good to be back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a reason Asia came to mind, I think. But we're going to put a pin in that, as we say on the podcast. Yeah. Oh, no. I will cover. Mm. I will recover and cover. So we are doing something a little bit different today. On your suggestion, you reached out to us and said you would like to do an episode on
Kind of Blue by Miles Davis,
which I remember you referencing in the prior podcast as your favorite album of all time. Is that right?
That's right. And there was the Nightfly, Kind of Blue, and Asia. So maybe that's where you're getting a little mixed up.
Thank you, sir.
Kind of Blue is number one.
Kind of Blue is number one. John, yeah. Nixon, where does Kind of Blue stand in your pantheon of overall albums and then with respect to the jazz genre?
Definitely top 10, probably top 5 favorite all time. I would call it a co-number one in terms of jazz with Brubeck's Time Out. And I think that there are some relationships between those two. They happened at the same time. You know, we just got past the eclipse, and they were almost like two different things that sort of passed and got near each other or seemingly near each other for a period of time, even though Brubeck was moving in the direction of saying, what can we do with time signatures? Miles Davis wanted to figure out what can we do different and challenge ourselves with harmony. So they went into very disparate places after this, but they were kind of close at this time. So those are my 1 and 1A in terms of jazz records.
Interesting. Okay. And Jonathan, as you know, this incarnation of a podcast got its origin story in yacht rock. And I think there are some interesting ties from today's topic to yacht rock. But was there a parallel that you thought of when you said, all right, I'm going to ask these yacht rock yahoos how we can talk about a jazz album from 1959?
Yeah, the first one that came to mind was the episode with Bob Clearmountain. And you were talking about reverb. And this album in the studio it was recorded had a great echo chamber. And that's immediately what got me thinking about this. The second is that we always say like these musicians in yacht rock are very influenced by jazz, and like, well, how were they influenced by jazz? So I wanted to just kind of talk about that. And then the third thing is like the people on this album, I think were like the Lukathers, the Jay Gradens, the Jeff Porcaros of their time, really. So those are the key parallels I see.
That's what I thought and see as well. And I think what we'll explore relative to personnel is you had a lot of the same players playing on each other's albums contemporaneously, sometimes the same style, but sometimes a different area of jazz, like John was mentioning. But there was, I don't know, 12 to 15 of the same names keep coming up on these same records, John?
Yeah, and they were booked as, in a lot of ways, session guys. There were times where an artist would be doing a record and they would just say, get me so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so to make up the combo, and they record the record. In other situations, maybe they form a band that stays together for a few albums, a short period of time, but those players are still, again, also doing sessions on other people's records, as you say. So it was the jazz world was a session call environment, and so there is that definite similarity.
Yep. Okay, well, let's dive in. Can I still use that pun? Does it still get a bell? Okay, well, let's dive in to probably the most famous of all of Miles Davis's albums, and maybe the most famous jazz album of all time, Kind of Blue. Jonathan, for those who have no familiarity with the name Miles Davis, which I don't believe many of those people listen to this podcast. How would you describe Miles Davis or put him in sort of context for this episode?
I mean, the greatest, perhaps the greatest jazz musician of all time. He played with everybody when he was coming up, Charlie Parker, and he assembled all the greats for his band, and those people went on to do great things when he became a band leader. So he's just iconic. I mean, just a giant in jazz.
So identifiable to the sound where he's got the mute on that jazz trumpet. It's like, I know it's not always Miles, but it's like,
yeah,
that just, that sounds, that's Miles.
And you mentioned him as a band leader. I think that's one of the big things that to point out, because when people hear you say the greatest jazz musician of all time, they can probably think of somebody that can out riff Miles or just does shows more. But Miles' genius was in putting together bands, and he was willing to put together a band where he was not the focal point. Even though his name was on the record, when you listen to the album, the soloists that he amass often get more attention, larger times in order to explore their sound than even he does. He defers, much in the way we compared Chuck Mangione. Said, Mangione doesn't take the biggest, most noteworthy solos in his albums. He gives them to Vidala and Grant Geissman and so on. So there's that similarity. That's his genius, is he was known for his ego, but he was humble enough to say, I want great people around me, and I'm going to let them be the show.
Well, John, I'm going to let you nerd out a little bit here. And by the way, for the sake of ease, today I will be referring to John, meaning my co-host John Nixon, and Jonathan, our special guest today.
So, yeah, that clears John, it up for me, too. Okay,
yeah. Okay, good, good.
I never go by John. Keep up. That's just a non-starter for me, so it's okay.
No, I wouldn't either if I were you. I mean, the name has been sullied. Okay, so let's talk about the style. You talked about the sort of convergence of where you said Brubeck and Davis were kind of at, but in different areas, right?
Right.
This was an exploration of a sort of new type of, at least new at the time, type of composition or yes, structure, something called modal yes, music. Why don't you explain to the non-nerds what that means as accessibly as you can?
Okay, prior to now, music through the 30s, 40s, and early part of the 50s was built on sophisticated, they grew more sophisticated, chord changes. We have talked in the past about the 2-5 and jazz. You'll hear definite changes of chords, and I think people roughly know what that means. When you think of all the standards, you know, whether we're talking Misty or you know, My Funny Valentine, you can hear these different chord changes happen, and that's what's giving you the structure underneath the melody to create your song. Now, in modal music, we mentioned this during the Minneapolis episode, modal music is an umbrella term that means we're not going to rely on chord changes and motion that way. What we're going to do is say, okay, here is the key. Here's the basic set of notes. And it may not be a minor or a major. There are other modes in between these minors and majors that have different combinations of those same notes. And we're going to say, this is the mode we're going to be in for this song. We may or may not change the root motion, meaning the bass line may not move around, or maybe it will. But essentially, instead of doing chords, we're saying, here is the scale. Now it's up to the players in their improvisations to make it musical, find melodies, find structures within this context. So that was the sort of challenge. Jazz musicians love to challenge themselves and say, here is something that hasn't been done before. Can we do it? And that was what this was. So you're going to hear music that is structured in a different way.
Jonathan, safe to assume that this sort of thing appeals to you in your ear?
It does. It just sounds different to me. I'll say also, I've dabbled in piano. And I know that when I was learning So What, I found it a lot easier to solo over the chord that exists in So What, even though it's a, which is one of the songs we're going to get to, even though it's a modal tune, there's a chord that you do play and can solo over. Right. And that gets into more technical things that I know about, but it's just easier. And in researching this, Donald Fagen said that because he was not traditionally trained, he found modal music much easier to jam on. And that's why he loves this album so much, because it was easier for him to play on, easier for him to just sound like he really knew what he was doing, even though he didn't have all the training.
Yeah, so soloing over chord changes in the jazz world can be more difficult because you have to know what new series of notes is constantly coming down the pipe as each new chord is approaching. In modal music, you don't have that challenge. You can almost play to the point where if you know the scale, every note sounds good, but that's not what makes it difficult. What makes it difficult is then making something musical out of it, because the challenge of jazz prior to this had been, can you accomplish staying in the key and hitting the right notes at the right time? Now this says, well, we're not worried about that. We want to make melodies in places that are difficult to construct melodies.
All right, cool. Well, we'll come back to that because we're going to hear some of this stuff shortly. But let's do the Yacht Rock thing, Jonathan, and talk about personnel. Who is the personnel? We've got, what, a quintet on this record?
I always get my my numbers confused. We actually have seven players, and only there's a max of six that appear at any one time on each song. And what's going on is, I'll just run down the players. We've got Miles Davis on trumpet, John Coltrane on tenor sax, Julian Cannonball Adderley on alto, Paul Chambers on bass, Jimmy Cobb on drums, who I happened to see in 2018 at the Beacon Theater, which is one of the last times he performed. And then we have, this is really interesting, we have two pianists. We have Bill Evans and we have Wynton Kelly. And for a variety of reasons, they're two, because Miles liked the sound that Bill Evans had, but Bill Evans wasn't available, so he was working with Wynton Kelly. And there's a really interesting kind of thing, and it reminds me of like the Steely Dan thing, where they would just bring in different bands to record songs. Like one day you'd have one band doing it, next day. Well, actually, on the first session for this, Miles asked both pianists to get there, and Wynton Kelly shows up thinking he's the guy. It's like, who's this other pianist here? Bill Evans. And that caused a little bit of tension, but they worked it out. And so that's why there's seven people credited to the album, but only maximum of six at any one time.
Yeah, and they're very different, Evans and Kelly. Kelly is more of a typical jazz player, whereas Bill Evans really comes at it from the perspective of his greatness. And his legend is in being one of the great jazz arrangers of all time, which is what he had been working on with Miles in the past. So he comes at it from a structure as an arranger. So his piano playing reflects that. And you're going to hear in the tune that he plays, it's a different sort of pastiche that he lays out, because he is thinking almost like an orchestra as he's building out. He's finding chords within this mode because he's got that arranger sensibility.
And rounding out the personnel, there's some, I don't know if controversy is the right word, but some confusion as to who should and does get production credit on this record. What do you know about that, Jonathan?
There's a bunch of different types of stories, but suffice it to say that everybody except Bill Evans and Miles Davis didn't really know what they were coming into the studio to play. Evans, for sure, is the author of one song, Flamenco Sketches, because it's based upon something that he did and Leonard Bernstein did, actually. There's controversy about So What and Blue and Green. So, and there were some arguments between Davis and Evans over the course of their lifespans. And at one point, Davis offered Bill Evans a $25 check to just settle the matter. but that didn't really go too far. But we'll never kind of know the exact answer, but there's some good proof to say that Evans did contribute, did write the songs, or at least two of them. And Davis didn't really want to admit that.
But isn't there even sort of lack of clarity as to who assumed the role of producer?
Well, it's credited to Tio Macero, and almost all the greatest jazz albums seem to have Tio Macero's name on it. But I think it's, at this time, the term of producer is sort of evolving. Early on, a producer had been just the person that put everything together, made sure that everybody was booked, had the studio time booked, the budgets were right, players showed up on time. It wasn't as much of a overseeing of the music in the way we know producer now, the way that they can creatively shape the sound of a song. You know, I guess if you're there and you're the one in the studio working on it at the time, you probably feel like you produced the record. So I don't know the controversy. Maybe Jonathan has something on that. But it is, the producer term in 1959 is different than the producer term that we know of by the 70s.
Wasn't the methodology unique in that they were close miking musicians separately as opposed to putting everyone in a room and having one or two mics kind of capture it all, John, isn't that?
Yes. What they did is, first of all, they were using a brand new microphone technology at the time, this Telefunken. It's credited as a U49, but there was never a U49. It's an M49. But a Telefunken was a brand new design that was a large capsule diaphragm mic, and it ran through a tube circuitry before it got to the board. So the large diaphragm allowed it to capture a full range of frequencies, and then you've got the nice smoothing of the sound through the tube. And so they close mic'd each instrumentalist, and there were three mics over the drum kit, one on the snare, and then I guess two overheads, maybe. That seems to be what it is. And so it adds up to a total of seven mics. And seven M49s at that time would have been a lot of dough, unless they were getting them as prototypes. I don't know. But and then I'm going to let Jonathan add on to this. They had a very unique situation. We've talked about with Bob Clearmountain how he would mic a stairwell and send audio signal into the stairwell and record it back, and that would become the reverb. In this case, they were using the basement. Now, Jonathan, what would you like to add on to that, if anything?
So this was recorded actually at the 30th Street Studio in New York City, which 207 East 30th, which now is occupied by some condominium building. But it was affectionately called the Church. And some people say it's the greatest sounding studio of all time. It was an old abandoned church that Columbia Records, which was at the top of the jazz game at the time of recording, they had this church. It was 97 feet by 50 feet by 55 feet high. And apparently it had such exceptional sound because of the wood that was used, the drapes that hung in the background, that the engineers at CBS, or Columbia, excuse me, said, don't touch it. Don't dust the drapes. Don't wash the floor. Don't do anything.
Don't even look at it.
Yeah, don't do anything that could change the sonic signature of the room. And it happened to have this basement room, and that's how they just did what Clearmountain did. That's, they ran a feed down there, a mic, ran it back up to the recording.
And it doesn't sound like it was a very enticing place. The basement, they talked about a low ceiling. So it's almost picture your basic rudimentary basement that we might know of, yet it just sounded wonderful for that particular purpose. And it's not a long chamber. It's just enough that it kind of gives you some additional space that sort of can glue the mix together.
Yeah. I think one thing that's really apparent from the get-go with this album, for anybody that's familiar with jazz or not familiar with jazz, is just the feeling of space and air around the recording. I mean, I used to have this roommate in college, and we would sit and we'd go, it just sounds so far away, but it sounds so close. And it sounds so different than like the recordings from Blue Note at the same time, which had a much more like upfront sound to me.
Well, let's give people a little taste, because the album opens with a track that is unmistakable. It is iconic all to itself, and that is So What.
Now, So What is interesting because even though it's a jazz song and we're talking about something that, a project that was built entirely on the concept of improvisation, in terms of if we were to look at it from a popular music standpoint, it's got two hooks right out of the gate. We got the bass line that is catchy, and then the two little piano stingers right after that become a secondary hook. So if you want to give somebody an album of jazz to listen to, Song One of Kind of Blue is immediately accessible.
Yeah. I almost think I am hearing chords, which I am hearing those two piano chords, but it's obviously it's within the strictures of a modal song. I just wanted to fast forward real quick. And the reason I brought wanted to give people a taste of So What goes back to the recording process that we mentioned earlier. Okay. On a headphones listen for the first time after Jonathan contacted us, I was struck, John, were you, at just how hot Coltrane's mic is in the left ear?
Yes. Yeah.
Holy smokes. Let's give a taste of Coltrane's first entrance. So if you're listening to this on headphones, you're like, I have to keep turning down whenever he takes a solo.
Well, the thing about Coltrane is that every single time on this record, you'll notice it when you listen through, is his entrances are so strong. There's a he just comes in with such an announcement every single time, like, "Oh, I'm here." You know, and he's so strong. It reminds me of a theory we always had about guitar solos, that if you make a great opening phrase on a guitar solo, you don't need to do anything else but kind of just stay above water at that point. Because that when you announce yourself like that, man, he just that you know what you're doing.
Yeah, obviously he had a seat in the mixing room too. kind of like legendarily Lars Ulrich mixed that one Metallica album and ended up being all drums and guitar and the bass was like potted all the way down. Not the case, because this is beautifully sounding to your point, Jonathan. So that is representative of what you were just trying to describe verbally, right? This that sonic palette that just is so good, especially through the modern remastering and all of that.
It's
gorgeous.
And you can hear it on other albums of the day. I mean, I think they used the studio up until the 70s and before it was torn down. I mean, Tony Bennett recorded there a lot. Bob Dylan recorded there. So it wasn't just a jazz place. I mean, it was in demand, which is part of the reason why they had to split this recording session over two dates, because it was just booked.
Yeah. One in March and one in April, or what
that's
was
correct.
It?
Yeah, that's correct.
Could you clarify something for me? Because as I'm getting now into more classic jazz over the last, I don't know, 5-10 years, I'm noticing on Spotify prop up all these remasters. I just mentioned remasters. Mm-hmm. And the name Rudy Van Gelder keeps coming up. And it's a name I had knew nothing about, but it's omnipresent now in the jazz world. What's Rudy Van Gelder's role in all of this?
Well, I think that y'all can speak to a little more about the miking techniques, but I can speak to the fact that there was this guy. His name was Rudy Van Gelder. He was an optician. I think he was an optician at that point. But he was just hanging out at jazz clubs in New York. And he said, I want to record some of you guys. So he brought him to his parents' house. I think it was in Hackensack, New Jersey. And apparently his parents' house had this great, like the living room had this great cathedral ceiling. And the sound was so good that that's where Blue Note, the label, kind of said, we're going to record here. And I think ultimately it got to the point where they had to move out to a studio that he founded, which replicated the sound amazingly. But yeah, it was just this guy who didn't really train to be an engineer, but became one because of his parents' living room.
Well, some of these had to be sort of fixed down the road. I guess you could argue whether the term fixed, because side A, when it was originally mixed and mastered, was like a quarter tone or so sharp because of a mismatch of the speed of the playback deck versus the recording deck. So it actually played back too fast, therefore it was sharp. And they went back. Well, that became an issue because a lot of jazz musicians like to play along with other jazz records, and now you're trying to play in tune with a record, and you're like, what is going on here? You're having to cram your mouthpiece on so hard in order to get it sharp enough. But they went back eventually and fixed that aspect of it, got it back into its proper intonation. Now, there's probably people that say that, you know, all of that, having it recorded wrong or mastered at the wrong speed, all of that is part of the record, leave it alone. But others went back and fixed it. So some of these remasters include that fix. And I think they've even tweaked the mix a little bit, even though it's only a 3-track. So it's not a sophisticated mix. A lot of those recordings at that time was you get what you get when you record it.
And so now they're releasing some of the alternate takes, too, in a lot of these extended bonus albums as well, which you can find on this album as well.
Yeah. One thing, too, about the recorder, they could only do that, go back to those tapes, because apparently they used Scotch 190 tape, which was a new thing at the time. And over time, it's been shown to hold up a lot better than Ampex tape, which was the main tape of the day. And so they were lucky that they made that decision, because it allowed them to go back to those backups to remaster.
Jonathan, we talked in one of the Chuck Mangione episodes. No, it was the episode that we did Best Solos, Non-Guitarist, and we talked about your point, John, about how Chuck Mangione would often let somebody else have the featured solo.
Yes.
But we touched on a common convention of the way that a jazz song is structured, and you mentioned it in your outline to us. So do you want to educate the class as to how these songs tend to flow? Because the next song, Freddie Freeloader, is another example of that.
So a jazz song's pretty simple. Basically, you play, there's a melody. You start out, you play in the melody. And once
called the hook?
Or
the head.
Yep. And then once that has been played, the band members take individual solos over top of the chords, or in this case, the modes, the scales. And they can go on for as long as they want. Usually there's some type of person kind of giving them the eye, like maybe wrap it up or who knows. But they go on, they do their thing, and then the band comes back together to play the head again. But at that point, it's kind of ending the song, so it's the outro. And that's pretty much a jazz song. A lot of people don't understand it, and maybe they just hear something going on in the middle. They don't understand why just one person's playing when there's a band, but it's a pretty simple concept if you can think about the whole of it.
And usually these songs are so long that you have to hit the head after you listen to one of them, right?
Yeah, nice. Very nice.
All right, John, get us back on track here. So I mentioned the next track is Freddie Freeloader. Does anyone else hear echoes of So What in that head?
I definitely do. You hear those some sort of, as you say, echo of those same two little piano chords. And this is one of those where it is a modal song, as the whole album is, but we have the bass part moves what it's doing in a pattern that would be similar to a blues progression. So it spends some time on the one chord, and then the bass might move to what would be the four chord, back to the one, five, four, one. It creates this sort of round that is typical of a blues song. So while we're hearing some aspects of it because of the root motion, the chords above it are not playing blues type chords. So they're taking a modal approach to blues.
Freddie Freeloader, what do you got on this one, Jonathan?
So there was actually a guy that there was a real Freddie Freeloader. He was like a hanger-oner to the band. So that's where the title comes from. The interesting thing here is this is the first song recorded for the album. And the reason is it goes back to those two piano players, because Wynton Kelly plays piano on this one. So they all get to the studio and Miles says, yeah, you're the guy, you play this one. But so he doesn't have to wait around if he doesn't want to hear the other songs being played by somebody else. Now, maybe he hung around, we don't know, but that's why this one was the first one recorded.
Anything else on this song before we move on to track three? Okay. Nobody raised their hands for those not watching at home. So the closing song on side one, which would have been the third of the three songs recorded in the first session date, right, Jonathan?
That's right.
Is what?
Blue and Green.
A little bit of a mood change for this one, correct?
That's right. It's the quietest song on the album. And Cannonball Adderley sits out on this one. Apparently, it started as a challenge. Bill Evans is over Miles Davis' apartment. And Miles liked to issue like little challenges, musical challenges with musicians. And I think he said, in my research, he said, see what you can do with these two chords, a G minor and an A augmented. And that's where it gets to be like the little bit of the controversy of, well, who actually came up with this? But if you listen to a Chet Baker tune, Alone Together, that was recorded prior to this album, you hear the opening chords to Blue and Green on it being played by Bill Evans.
Ah. Ooh. There you go. That might solve that mystery. John, you had something to add on this one.
Well, it was the Bill Evans aspect of it. When you hear this one, you do, because those two chords that he's talking about really don't belong in the same mode. They don't. It's not a case where all those notes are in one particular mode. So they're kind of getting outside of a pure modal aspect here. But they're, so you get a sense that there's chord changes happening. A lot of it's because of the way that Bill Evans is voicing things. Grant, I mean, we said about his arranger sensibility, but it's still sticking within one sort of umbrella of which they're establishing for the soloist. But this one does have a almost more of a soundtrack feel to me.
Hmm. It's funny you say soundtrack, and I'm going to defer to the experts because I'm going by memory. This is a song that features that muted trumpet, right? By mm-hmm. Miles, that signature sound. This is the song that sounds like the soundtrack to a film noir detective movie under yeah. which, you know, somebody's complaining about a dame walking into their gin joint, you know, that type of thing. That's right. The vibe I get.
Okay. I don't disagree.
We are ready to flip this bad boy over. Side two features only two tracks, but begins where the other side leads off, maybe, because we're still talking about a kind of blue. In this case, Jonathan.
It is all blues. So this was the first song recorded a little more than, what was it, about 30 days later. It's one of the songs that I like to think has a Doobie bounce on this album. And it's not fast, it's not slow, but it's got something, and it's like it's a foot tapper, you know? And Maurice White, who, I'm a big fan of Earth, Wind & Fire, he mentioned that this is a waltz. It's a 3-4 time song, but he said it flowed effortlessly like a river, and Miles just made that the one, which is the downbeat, just disappear. There wasn't any stop. It could just go on forever. And I have seen like jam bands, rock jam bands, when they want to venture into jazz, play this. It's a perfect song. Just you can play on it forever.
Yeah, it's got that bum, 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 which does, that is the whole root of the song, is that motion. And this is in a mode called Mixolydian, which I don't need to explain, but what it's, by virtue of that dum, 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 well, we'll let them play a little bit of it here first. All right, so that piano motion that you're hearing there is, I often see it on sheet music misrepresented, because they'll call that a G7 chord, and really,
how dare they?
It's, you never get a true G7 because of that motion. Means that the two notes that must be together at the same time to create a G7 chord do not ever play at the same time if it's played correctly. So it's like dancing around, sort of hinting maybe we're going to do G7, but we don't. And then, like a blues, it moves to the 4 chord, and it kind of does the same thing, but it's often written wrong because they're writing it as though the regular dominant jazz blues chords. And that's not what's happening here. It's all about the motion of that bum, 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 bum. That is the core of the song.
You mentioned that sophistication, and Jonathan mentioned Doobie Bounce. So let's bring it back to Yacht Rock in a way. And so we hear the likes of Bill Champlin and Steve Lukather talk about growing up chords. So when they are trying to infuse concepts of jazz into rock and roll, is what you get the Steely Dan wing of Yacht Rock, right?
Yes.
This is why a Yacht Rock podcast, such that we were, would even embrace this. Because Jonathan, to your point, I want to go back because you made it initially, is that the rock musicians of the late 70s are dipping into the jazz chops of the late 50s and saying, well, how can we apply it? And sometimes it becomes amazingly sophisticated, like Steely Dan, and sometimes it's really kind of inaccessible, also like Steely Dan.
Yeah. You know, Lukather did a cover of this with Larry Carlton. Peter Frampton did a cover of this with Larry Carlton. It's like a theme, I guess. Larry Carlton's brought in.
Well, he's always we always consider him as a jazz soloist playing in a rock and roll song.
It's true.
Well, let's wrap up the record, and then we'll continue to chit-chat a little bit more about the album's impact and influences. But the
one more thing I thought was interesting on that song, real quick. Blues. Yeah, one more thing I wanted to mention on All Blues, that you were talking about the bounce or the feel of that riff or the count. When I hear that dum 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 dum, I hear 1 2 3 4 5 6 1 2 3. I'm hearing that in six, right? And then we're going to listen here when the solos kick in. It goes. You listen to the drummer, and he brings in the ride cymbal, and suddenly it's clear jazz waltz. 1 2 3 1 2 3. Hit it. So I like the way that changes with the drummer. You don't hear the ride until the solos kick in, and it just lifts the song, and suddenly you feel like you're in a new space. You feel like the tempo's picked up. It probably hasn't, but it's a nice touch.
We're going to move into track five now, which is Flamenco Sketches. Do either of you feel like after the mood turns on side A with Blue and Green, that the rest of the album exhibits a certain melancholy that the two opening tracks did not, or is that just me?
I agree with that. Yes, I do. As I look at Freddie Freeloader being second, yes, definitely. And Flamenco Sketches is in talk about modes, it's in what's called a Phrygian mode, which is the mode, granted the name flamenco points to that, but it is the mode that when you think of the classic, like old Tex-Mex Western with the guy that comes out with the big old Mexican guitar and starts playing, and that sound of notes, of chords, is what the Phrygian mode sounds like. And they also use it, oddly enough, it is the mode of dark metal. So put those Phrygian. Two things together and mix them up.
Phrygian mode sounds like it must be cool jazz, Jonathan.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is a melancholy type album, but also remember Freddie Freeloader was recorded first, so we got that piano, like Wynton Kelly, a totally different type of piano player. He's done with his part, and now Evans takes over, introduces a whole different sound. But you know, the name of the album, we haven't really talked about that. It was kind of indicative of some of the puns, and I know you all like puns, of Miles's albums at the time, like Milestones, Milestones, or Miles Ahead. So it's like kind of blues. So it's like it wasn't really blues, but it's like quasi-blues. I think that's why, like, to me, I just identify with it. It's not unhappy music. It's not happy music. It just exists in this murky in between.
And that's why I think it's somewhat accessible, as I said early on, and another reason why I compare it to Dave Brubeck's Time Out, because if you had to sit somebody down for the first time to listen to jazz, this is something that they could stomach. I wouldn't, you know, give them what was the Coltrane one?
A Love Supreme.
A Love Supreme. Yeah. If you think about Coltrane's Love Supreme, now that you wouldn't want to give someone that as their first taste test into jazz, that's for sure.
Yeah. Now that's the kind of jazz that people have quipped. It sounds like everybody's playing a different song.
Yeah.
You know, in some of the jazz clubs, you can see the bass guy peeking. Anyways, because they're all playing with their eyes closed, right?
A quick little piece of trivia. So they recorded take five at the same studio. And
no kidding. Yeah. Ooh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was recorded there. Same piano that Evans is playing, and apparently it has this distinct sound because Brubeck, being like really percussive, just beats up a piano, and there's very little felt left on the hammers.
Oh,
so it gives that piano that signature sound.
It gets brighter as it gets older, right? If you don't change out the felt, which most studios will not, they like the brighter.
Yeah,
well, Cool. I'm going to pull a pin out before we get into the lightning room round. And the pin is, so 5 years, we talked about the personnel shuffling between all these players and maybe 15, 20 cats that keep showing up. One of which is a guy by the name of Wayne Shorter, who joins the Miles Davis Quintet in 1964. The name Wayne Shorter should sound familiar to yacht rock lovers because of, here it is, wait for it.
He played
the solo on
Asia.
Yes, Asia. Sir.
That's right.
So now we are back, and I proved why I brought up Asia in the first place. So that iconic saxophone solo we talked a million times, they pulled a contemporary from Miles Davis in that era onto a recording in 1978 to, amongst other things, showcase their love for jazz. So I thought that's cool.
Along with Victor Feldman, too, who played on some Miles' albums.
Yes, exactly. So the connections are clear.
And wasn't, when we talked about Nightfly, wasn't that Sonny Rollins on the cover of the record sitting on the cut? Yeah. Okay.
True. There you go. Yep. All right. Well, I have some things for the lightning round. Shall we partake, gentlemen?
All right.
Yeah.
If I could just lead us off real quick, because I don't want anyone else to steal it. But Jonathan, you heard us talk to Mark Jordan. Right? Last season, he released a traditional jazz album, and he was always struck by how, in his view of things or in his ear, he heard Tears for Fears, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, in the sort of convention of so what? So he treated it thusly. To hear it, can't
yeah,
you?
He's right.
Yep. Yeah, so that was Found at Sea from way back when. So good job, Mark Jordan.
I don't know if these are buried treasures or I don't know. They're just things that
hold on. You know how this goes. You've been listening long enough. First, we got to do Found at Sea. John Nixon, do you have anything?
All right. I am going to defer the rest of my time to Jonathan for the lightning round. But since he has nothing for Found at Sea, I'll tell you what I found at sea. I went looking just to find other songs that maybe had the word blue in them. You know, I had to tie it in somehow.
We only got a few minutes left.
No. I just needed one because I found one. And I was just taken by the personnel. So this personnel is interesting to me. I found Baby Blue by Seals and Cross from Get Closer. Never try to get me up. It's so hard to do. Cause every time we live it up, I'm so in love with you. You're all over my mind. So the personnel on that album, or particularly that song, Louis Shelton, Ray Parker Jr., Lee Ritenour, David Paich, Joe Sample, David Hungate, Jeff Porcaro, and Jim Horn. So there's your Found at Sea, Baby Blue, and it's got lots of nice personnel.
And would you consider it yachty?
No.
Sort of? Yeah? Oh, no. Okay.
No, yacht adjacent. Contemporary yacht adjacent. Yachty. Yeah.
All right. I do have a buried treasure, but I'm going to let our guest go first. All Jonathan, right. What do you have?
Well, so I look at this as like, what is the music that got me into jazz? Because I didn't just, I probably liked yacht rock, even though that wasn't the term at that time, way before I liked jazz. So one of the first is, we've been talking about him, is Feel So Good by Chuck Mangione. It was a popular song, but it introduced me to the concept of soloists and just, you know, I don't know where it fits in the jazz canon or if it occupies the yacht rock canon. I don't know, but it's just a great song and great solos.
Indeed.
I wanted to bring it back to the yacht as well. I want to go back to Steely Dan. My buried treasure is a session saxophonist by the name of Pete Christlieb.
Oh, yeah.
So he highly influenced by jazz. I think he would consider himself first and foremost a jazz saxophonist. But what's interesting about what he brings to the song FM on this. So let's first back up. So a yacht rock saxophone solo by Ernie Watts or David Sanborn has these flourishes or melodies. It's very smooth sounding, I think, historically. The second sax solo in FM, there are two, both by Pete Christlieb, really sounds super jazzy to me in that it's sort of feels like it's playing in a modal concept and not necessarily going for melody. So let's hear some of that. Anyways, it's not a typical quote-unquote yacht rock jazz saxophone solo, so I thought that was relevant. All right, back to you, John. You have no buried treasures, John? You're ceding all your time to...
I'm ceding my time to the senator from...
Florida. Right, which could be dangerous. Okay. I'm going to go to the yacht, to the rock arena, and I was looking for songs that were apparently modal. And one of the ones, I'm not a huge Santana fan, but one of the songs that I do like from Santana is Evil Ways. And mm-hmm. I can totally hear the modal aspect of it because it is a song that could just go on forever. You got to change your evil ways, baby. Before I start loving you, you got to change, baby. Yeah, that's a good call. Do we know for sure that that's modal, or we're just hearing modal? My ears aren't sophisticated enough.
Well, it's built off those two chords going back and forth, and so that's sort of outlining the mode. There isn't a whole lot of chord changes in that, so that absolutely is a good example.
Cool. Well, I do have something for a final thought. Jonathan, do you?
I would say that, I mean, it's funny, when I was doing the research, like everything was saying, like, you need to have this in your collection. And like, what is a collection these days? So I'm just going to say, if you don't have this downloaded somewhere, where if the internet were to go out, then I suggest you download it. Make sure that it's locally available, Kind of Blue. And that's...
Or even better, physical format.
Physical format, right? Yeah.
I agree 100% with that, yes. We've had mysterious disappearances of great records on streaming services. So absolutely, if you like it, download it, keep it somewhere. And don't necessarily just keep it in your Apple Music, because... those things have a way of disappearing when Apple decides they don't want you to have it anymore.
Get me started. No, yeah. They want you to have it, but you just got to buy it again.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's true.
All right, gentlemen, if you will oblige, I have a final thought for which I wanted to sort of change the subject, but also keep it on topic. And that
How do you do that?
You'll find out.
How?
My personal Kind of Blue is not Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. My personal Kind of Blue, which I hold up as the ultimate jazz album of all time.
Is this one of those identifies as sort of situations? Come on now.
Sort of. Well, the album is called Soul Station by Hank Mobley.
Ah, yes.
Hank Mobley is a contemporary and often collaborator with the likes of Miles Davis and all these other cats. He was in the Jazz Messengers. He put out an album in 1960 that I think, like I said, Soul Station. First of all, the cover is Kind of Blue, so it's got that. See how I'm doing this?
Yeah.
And it's just brilliant. So going back to what Jonathan just said, you can get this remastered, reissued on Blue Note at your local record store, on high whatever the awesome vinyl is. Go get that, it's awesome. But he's got an earlier album this album is from 1959, the album that preceded it, called Roll Call. I wanted to ask you, gentlemen, if you hear any so what echoes, but not in a modal mode, in a more accessible jazz mode, to this song called A Baptist Beat. So personnel, just so you know, we've got Whitten Kelly on this one, Paul Chambers, Art Blakey, like I said, Freddie Hubbard. It's all the same names as the other stuff. But what I like, if you are someone for whom, like myself, who is not sophisticated enough to find Miles Davis accessible, Hank Mobley is a good analog that plays probably more in like the blues structure or more of a chord-driven kind of stuff. It's really good stuff. So go out and get it, y'all.
You've been waiting for how many years to hawk some Hank Mobley on this show?
I think it's been six years.
A couple of copies of those for me to try and introduce me to Hank Mobley, which it's a good call for sure. But yeah. I'm wondering if you started this whole podcast based on how do I work my way 5 years? It's a long play the long game. 5 years out for Hank Mobley reference.
I've been found out. Oh, jeez. Well, Jonathan, get us out of here before I get exposed any further.
Well, as Hank Mobley might say, or could have said, at the end of a session, ahoy polloi.
He might.
He did.